taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans.
Helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you were every day American.
Hello there, everyday Americans. Welcome to back to the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. I'm glad you could join me. Today's going to be a little different. I'm not actually going to start out with a news article. April 30th, 1789, was the inauguration of George Washington, the very first president, the very first inauguration of a president of the United States. And I wanted to take this time to look a little bit at what he said during this inauguration and maybe use it as information, as fodder, for something we should consider here in the 21st century. You know, a lot has changed since the 18th century, but people still remain the same. So let's look at this. You can find this, by the way, if you want to read the entire speech, go to founders.archives.gov and just search for First Inaugural Address, and you can get the transcript of the final version of the original speech. Now, it's interesting to note that he starts out his speech with fellow citizens of the Senate and of the House of Representatives. The inauguration speech wasn't to the American people. He wasn't recording his words to be placed in newspapers around the 13 states. He is addressing Congress, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. And he says, among the vicissitudes incident to life, no event could have filled me with greater anxieties than that of which the notification was transmitted by your order and received on the 14th day of the present month. Of all the things in life, of all the vicissitudes of life, he was filled with anxiety by being chosen the President of the United States. This is a man who had served his country for years. This is a man who had fought the most powerful military in the world at the time and won. This is a man who had been through Valley Forge. He'd been through the whiskey rebellions. He had been through a lot in the service of his country. And being chosen as president filled him with anxiety. He explains, on the one hand, I was summoned by my country, whose voice I can never hear but with veneration and love, from a retreat which I had chosen with the fondest predilections and, in my flattering hopes, with an immutable decision as the asylum of my declining years. George Washington had retired. He had given so much to his country that he sought only peace, quiet, for his declining years, to spend his remaining life on earth in peace. But he was called. He was summoned. And he says, not by the members of the House and the Senate, not even by the electors appointed by the state legislatures. No, he was summoned by his country. His country needed him. And he was willing to serve. You see a man who is not selfish, who's not looking out for his own. You see a man who understands the importance of the situation he is being placed in, not only as president, but as the very first president. Many of the traditions, some of which have become law, that revolve around the presidency were formed by this man. And he understands the weight placed on him and the importance that he would give up his retirement. He would give up his relaxation. He would give up the peace of living on his farm for the struggle of being not only president, but the first president of the United States. He goes on the other hand, the magnitude and difficulty of the trust to which the voice of my country called me, being sufficient to awaken in the wisest and most experienced of her citizens a distrustful scrutiny into its qualifications, could not but overwhelm and despondence one who, inheriting inferior endowments from nature and unpracticed in the duties of civil administration, ought to be peculiarly conscious of his own deficiencies. He understood not only the magnitude of what he was being asked to do, the difficulty, but he looked at himself and says, I'm not worthy. He says he's overwhelmed with despondency. Looking at himself, he says, I don't have the skills. I am not naturally or practiced in the art of civil administration. I haven't done this. He was conscious of his own limitations. But he served because he was asked. Again, he continues, all I dare hope is that if in executing this task I have been too much swayed by a grateful remembrance of former instances or by an affectionate sensibility to this transcendent proof of the confidence of my fellow citizens, and have thence too little consulted in my incapacity as well as disinclination for the weighty and untried cares before me, my error will be palliated by the motives which misled me, and its consequences be judged by my country with some share of partiality in which they originated. He knows he's going to make mistakes. He knows, he's prepared. He says, if in executing these tasks, I've been swayed by former remembrances, I've been affectionate to the call, that I've been puffed up by the trust laid in me. I thought too highly of myself, to put another way, that he would be judged by the fact that he was chosen to a job that had not existed before. That his errors come not from malice, but from a love of his country and his willingness to sacrifice for its start to be a good one. A little later, he went on to say, such being the impression under which I have, in obedience to the public summons, repaired to the present station, it would be peculiarly improper to admit in this fact in my first official act, my fervent supplication to the Almighty Being who rules over the universe, who presides in the councils of nations, and whose providential aid can supply every human defect that his benediction may consecrate to the liberties and happiness of the people of the United States, a government instituted by themselves for these essential purposes, and may enable every instrument employed in its administration to execute with success the functions allotted to his charge. He says, okay, I will be obedient, but it's not me alone. He's going to ask God for help, because he recognizes the Almighty rules over the universe. It's God who presides over the councils of nations. And it is God's aid that has supplied not only many, many instances during the war, but it's God's providence that can supply where man is deficient. He is humble enough to know he can't do this alone, that he needs the help of the Almighty, and that he begs that God will consecrate the liberties and happiness of the people of the United States, that they will give them a government instituted by the people for the essential purpose of protecting their rights, their liberties, and their happiness, and that God may enable every instrument employed to its administration, every person that executes these laws, to do them with success, to execute their jobs properly. Continuing on, by the article establishing the Executive Department, it is made the duty of the President, quote, to recommend to your consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient, close quote. The circumstances under which I now meet you will acquit me from entering into that subject farther than to refer to the great constitutional charter under which you are assembled, and which, in defining your powers, designates the objects to which your attention is to be given. See, it's this second article of the Constitution that created the executive department. And part of his duty is what we call the State of the Union Address. Only it's not constitutionally State of the Union Address. It is telling Congress, giving them a report on the State of the Union. Well, this is the first inaugural. There isn't much there. The president doesn't have much to report to Congress. But he does remind them that the Constitution under which they are assembled defined their powers and designated the objects to which their attention should be given. A quick look at the federal government today shows that not only does the executive department not focus on the objects to which the Constitution gave it charge, but neither does Congress, neither do the courts. The Constitution seems more as an impediment to doing what must be done rather than the charter that gives them authority in a limited and defined place. The very first inaugural reminded the members of Congress that their powers are limited and defined and that they should keep their attentions there. One of my favorite lines from this speech, quote, "And since the preservation of the sacred fire of liberty and the destiny of the Republican model of government are justly considered as deeply, perhaps as finely staked on the experiment entrusted to the hands of the American people." The sacred fire of liberty. You know, we talk about freedoms, we talk about rights, we talk about liberty, but it seems most people I encounter have a rather thin and veiled understanding of these things. A sacred fire. Think of the Olympic torch, or think of the fire on the altar in ancient Israel. Those fires represented something, and he's referring to the sacred fire of liberty, the ability to live unencumbered, except as necessary by the will of others. And the Republican model of government, we hear today America referred to as democracy, the American democracy, democracy this, democracy that. We are not a democracy. Our founding fathers feared democracies. The dictionary defines a democracy as a government by the people, a form of government in which the supreme power is lodged in the hands of the people collectively, or in which the people exercise the powers of legislation. Now, what did our founding fathers think about this? Alexander Hamilton said, "We are now forming a republican form of government. Real liberty is not found in the extremes of democracy, but in moderate governments. If we incline too much to democracy, we shall soon shoot into a monarchy or some other form of dictatorship." Think of that as people are saying, we need more democratic processes. We are a democracy. We need to improve democracy. No, we need to improve a republican form of government. The moderate republican form of government. Thomas Jefferson said, "A democracy is nothing more than mob rule, where 51% of the people may take away the rights of the other 49. That is a perfect example of society today." Our democracies are where mobs of people are taking away the rights of people they disagree with. And it doesn't even need to be 51%. It just needs to be a loud enough group to grab the attention of those with power and influence. And my personal favorite, democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for lunch. Liberty is a well-armed lamb contesting the vote. So Washington was right. We're trying to preserve a republican model of government. The destiny of the republican model of government is in the hands of the American people. The sacred fire of liberty and the destiny of the republic are staked in the hands on the experiment entrusted to us. That's why when you look out at our nation and you see things falling apart, you see governments out of control, you see Congress ignoring the Constitution, you see the president legislating with a pen and a phone, you see courts that ignore the Constitution, you see mayors and governors infringing on rights, the problem ultimately rests in us. The experiment entrusted to the hands of the American people. And sadly, today it seems we're failing. Now, Washington concluded his message with this: "Having thus imparted to you my sentiments, as they have been awakened by the occasion which brings us together, I shall take my present leave, but not without resorting once more to the benign parent of the human race, in humble supplication that since he has been pleased to favor the American people with opportunities for deliberating in perfect tranquility and dispositions for deciding with unparalleled unanimity on a form of government for the security of their union and the advancement of their happiness, so this divine blessing may be equally conspicuous in its enlarged views, the temperate consultations, and the wise measures on which the success of this government must depend." Washington once again pleads to God. He petitions God, the benign parent of the human race. He comes in supplication that the American people have been given this opportunity, that they will not blow it. The opportunity to deliberate in tranquility, to discuss and debate, not argue, fight, and malign. For a form of government where the American people, yes, we elect representatives to enact our power, to represent us, but that it not be given out of control, that the union would be secure by abiding by the rules and the law that is the Constitution. A union that was designed to advance not only the happiness of the American people. Why? So the divine blessing may be equally conspicuous in the enlarged views and the temperate consultations and the wise measures on which the success of the government must depend. Not to think small, not to think narrowly, not to be bigoted based on party or preference or race or gender, but to have enlarged views and temperate consultations, which is something we have been lacking for years in this country. You cannot have a temperate debate, it seems, in many parts of this country. You will be shouted down, you will be canceled, you will be maligned, you will be slandered. You will be labeled with atrocious labels, not because of anything you have done, but because of what someone perceives some group you're a part of. You cannot have temperate consultations in such a situation, in such an environment of hate and vitriol. We cannot enact wise measures that are necessary for our Republican form of government to succeed when the goal of those in power, those writing the laws, those enacting and executing those laws, and those making determinations and judgments between parties in conflict, ignore the very law that created them. If that is the case, the government cannot succeed. The union cannot succeed. And it must do what it has been doing, and that is leaning more and more towards despotism and force to enact what a small group believe is right. In contravention of the Constitution or not. Even to the part of using the constitutional processes to promote a political gain. See, George Washington wasn't perfect. He was human. He made mistakes. But what you see is a humble leader that saw the office he was called to as a responsibility he must fulfill and do so wisely. Today, it seems those in our city halls and our state capitals and in Washington, D.C., see those offices as opportunities to exercise power, to enforce their will upon others. That is not the example George Washington has given us. And the examples are not only many, but they're obvious. Why, pray tell, do those in the Senate want to get rid of the filibuster? Because they cannot get a sufficient number of their colleagues to agree with them. You know, Washington said when he left in his farewell address, he warned that the alternate domination of one faction over another, sharpened by the spirit of revenge natural to party dissension, which in different ages and countries have perpetuated the most horrid enormities, is itself a frightful despotism. I can think of little language that would better describe what's going on in most of our legislatures today, in most of our governments today. Is there such a reluctance to agree in the Senate because of party bickering? Because of party dissension? Is there an inability to agree because one group's proposals are so beyond the pale that only devotion to party would encourage one to support it? And this is true of both parties, a pox on both of their houses. We are living in a frightful despotism where the desire to make the other party pay leads our representatives to attack our rights, to enfeeble us. Washington said, it serves always to distract the public councils and enfeeble the public administration. It agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms, kindles the animosity of one part against another, foments occasionally riot and insurrection. Look out the window. Look at the news. Our public councils now care little except for political party. Our public administrations are more than willing to trample the rights of the American people if they think it will get their party elected. They have agitated ill-founded jealousies and false alarms. Look at the cry and hue, the call for vengeance for a man who saved the life of a black woman by taking the life of another black woman, simply because the man is white. The animosity we exhibit, the animosity we see, has been stoked by those with party obligations. And sadly, the American people have allowed it to happen. The riots, the insurrections that have gone on for more than a year in this country are there in large part because we have let those with political agendas agitate us and kindle the animosity for others. If we want a better country, if we want to live free, if we want to secure the sacred fires of liberty, then we must take responsibility for those we hire. We must place the welfare of others above our party proclivities. We must take some advice from our first president and use that to help drive our country forward, to allow for discussion, debate, and deliberation, to allow for temperate consultations, or we will continue to be driven apart, separated based on party lines or party-induced agitations. And we'll have no one to blame but ourselves. So before we head out to break, I want to remind you, you can find other material like this at constitutionstudy.com. That's where I post my articles and videos, and you can find that as well as on the AmericaOutloud.com website. There's a lot of information there. But I want to encourage you to check out constitutionscholars.com. That's scholars with an S. It's a community that we're building of people who are interested in the Constitution and interested in learning about the Constitution. A scholar is not an expert. A scholar is a student. So I'm encouraging you, if you're at all interested in becoming a student of the Constitution, or if you already are a student and want to find others that are interested, head to the website constitutionscholars.com and you can find out more, and because you can join absolutely free. You can also find out more about my show, get all the latest podcasts. In fact, you can find out all the other interesting and exciting shows that are available on America Out Loud. Just go to AmericaOutloud.com. You'll find me under our shows or under the schedule. You can listen to me live. If you can't listen to me live, then you can listen to the podcast and you can be engaged and you can become part of the solution rather than simply part of the problem. So please hang around, and I will be back with you after the break.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
AmericaOutloud.com is the alternative from the agenda-driven globalist. Here, we take on the challenges of our generation so that we can preserve future generations. On-demand podcast or real-time talk radio with our streaming apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've joined the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. If you missed the first half, please check out the podcast, because we discussed President Washington's first inaugural address. I quoted several pieces of that address to see what that man, the man that set the standard for presidents for over 200 years, what that man thought of the job, and how he would approach it. And what we saw in his quotes were, at least what I believe to be, a humble man. a man that recognized not only the importance of the position, but the importance of doing the job well, of recognizing the hand of God on him and the work in the United States, recognizing the limitations that were placed on him by the Constitution, a man that not only expressed anxiety over the role that he was being asked to fulfill, but great humility and hope in his ability to do it and do it well. And while it would be very easy to simply compare what Washington has done to what Biden is currently doing, and to do it in a way that would not show Biden in a very good light, I want to go beyond that. See, it seems in America, we have focused so much on the presidency, we forget that the job of president is not king or litigator. The president is not the most important man in the world, the most powerful man. He's not supposed to be. He's there to be a servant of the states. Now, the first thing you may say, wait, Paul, isn't he the servant of the people? No, he's the servant of the states. Article 2, Section 1 says the president is chosen by electors appointed by the legislatures or by the states based on the manner chosen by the legislature. The American people do not vote for president. They vote for electors that will choose the president. Now, that entire process is a whole other program, one that I probably won't do for a few more years. But the job of the president is not only to serve the states, there's actually very little the president can do all on his own. Read Article 2. He is the commander-in-chief, that is true, but only of the forces that are in service, and it is actually Congress that sets the rules. So while he is the commander-in-chief, he has to work within the rules set by Congress. Yes, the president appoints judges and officers and ambassadors, but they must be done with the advice and consent of the Senate. Notice it doesn't say appointed by the president and ratified or approved by Congress, or confirmed by Congress. It is the advice and consent of the Senate. We often lose that advice part. In fact, if you look, about the only things the president can do on his own, he can receive foreign dignitaries. He can issue pardons, absolutely. He can call Congress into joint session under extraordinary circumstances, or he can moderate a debate. He can, when the two houses can't decide about going into recess, he can fix that for them. Pretty much everything else the president does, he does with Congress. He can only sign a law after Congress has passed it. So the president is not the most powerful person. He's not supposed to be the most powerful person in the country. He's not even supposed to be the most powerful person at all. It's actually Congress where most of the powers of the United States are delegated. But because we have walked away from what the Constitution actually says, because we've not taught ourselves or our children, because we've let lawyers and politicians try to tell us what the Constitution says rather than finding out for ourselves, not only does the president ignore the Constitution when it's inconvenient, members of the Congress and members of the court do exactly the same thing. Now, there are three issues that have been top of mind lately. They've been in the news a lot lately, and they are examples of a lack of understanding of what the Constitution says and the rules it establishes for Congress to act. Let's start with the idea of the filibuster. There is nothing in the Constitution about a filibuster. Article 1, Section 5, Clause 2 of the Constitution reads, "Each House may determine the rules of its proceedings." The filibuster is nothing but a rule that the Senate has adopted. Now, why? We look at a little bit of history and we notice we have what's called a bicameral legislature. We have two houses. Now, those two houses were meant to serve two different purposes. They had two different, if not agendas, at least points of view. The House of Representatives is just that. It is the representatives of the people. That's why the members of the House are chosen by the people every 2 years. Where the Senate, on the other hand, was originally, the senators were chosen by the state legislatures. Now understand, that should give you an understanding of the two different viewpoints. The House of Representatives was meant to be the representatives of the people, and the Senate, the representatives of the states. And it was expected that if you are a member of the House, well, first of all, House members were not expected to be professional politicians. It was expected that if your neighbors thought you would be qualified, you should serve as a representative in Congress, that like President Washington, you would see that as a calling upon from your fellow citizens to serve, and you would do so. And because of that, it was expected that the House would have a lot of turmoil. If you look at the House rules, there is a limit on debate. There's a time limit established by the leadership because it was expected to be a bit more rambunctious. Whereas you look at the Senate has no time limit on debate. In fact, the Senate was referred to as the saucer where the heated coffee of the House would go to cool. It was meant to be a deliberative body. It is why in the House you serve for 2 years, because again, you're a citizen. You show up, you do your 2 years, you go home. Whereas the Senate, appointed by legislators, were expected to be a bit more professional, to have shown the skills and temperament for being in the Senate. That as having a 6-year term, would not be dealing with being reelected every couple of years. And they were there to represent the states. So before federal law could be passed, not only did it have to be passed by the representatives of the people, by the representatives of the states. And that's where these rules, like the unlimited debate, that debate could only be stopped by what's called a cloture vote, by a vote saying, okay, we've had enough debate, let's go on to voting, whatever this thing is before us. Now in 1913, with the passage of the 17th Amendment, the states were removed from representation in the Congress because the senators were now chosen by the people of the states. Their job was the same. Their job was to represent the states in the federal government, but they were no longer chosen by the state governments. They were chosen by the people, and they have been turned into another House of Representatives. Which kind of makes sense when if you look at the debate about the filibuster, because if you view the Senate as just another House of Representatives, if you expect the same turmoil that you would get in the House of Representatives, the filibuster would be an impediment. Why take the time and effort to negotiate, to debate, to deliberate? Or as President Washington said, for temperate consultations, to convince, to win over, to explain to a supermajority of the Senate that your reason is good, that your goals are correct, that your method is proper, and that you have the legal authority to do this. Why bother if we can just as a party, take control of the Senate. Getting rid of the filibuster is not about improving debate. It's about getting rid of an impediment to bad law. And I'm, for one, am thankful for Senator Manchin. As long as he stands up and says, no, we're not going to get rid of the filibuster simply because the Democratic Party can't get their agenda through because they refuse to compromise, to recognize that they are not hired as dictators, that they are servants, that they do not rule, the people rule, that if they want to put something forward, they must get sufficient numbers of the representatives of the people and the states to agree to it. Simply saying, well, Congress can't get anything done, to me, that's a good thing. It's designed that way. We don't want Congress doing things. Why? Because they're exercising powers that have not been delegated to them. Congress actually has only about, depending on how you count them, only about 30 different powers delegated to it to the Constitution, 17 of which are normal, routine, everyday things like, coining money or passing the legislation to enact the powers of the United States that have been delegated to it by the Constitution, not whatever power Congress feels like. Congress is not supposed to do much. Washington is not supposed to have a significant role in your life. So anything that impedes that, to me, is a benefit to society. But we see, in this case, one political party, and I blame one political party for using their slim majority in an attempt to destroy the deliberative body of the Senate, to take over the government of the United States, to, in effect, have a soft coup, to prevent their opposing party from having a chance, a say, a significant influence on legislation. There's only two reasons to get rid of the filibuster. One is to deal with an obstructive counterparty. The other is to take control of the body. Now, the Democrats should have already learned that that is a dangerous thing because they got rid of the filibuster for judicial nominees and it bit them in the backside. But if I look at that, I'm like, okay, this is the exercise of power. We say the same thing with the attempt to pack the Supreme Court. Now, contrary to what politicians have said, replacing justices is not packing the court. Simply getting justices that you don't like is not packing the court. That is a lie meant to foment anger, meant to found jealousies, to kindle animosity, because, again, one party didn't get their way. Now, understand, I dislike both parties, a pox on both their houses. They have both done significant damage to this country. But today, I see one party trying to take over the Senate and now trying to take over the judiciary. See, we're supposed to have three branches of government to act as checks and balances. But just as in the 1930s with FDR, we have President Biden and the Democrats today wanting to take over the Supreme Court. Now, the only advantage in 1930 is it was only the president that wanted to take over the court. Even the Democrats in the 1930s thought FDR was going too far. But today we have the Democrats in the House and the Senate pressuring so that they can, once again, their party can rule the judicial branch. Why? Well, because we've so ignored the Constitution that when the Democratic Party can't get their way via legislation or by executive order, they want to get it by the courts. And they have for decades. And they're seeing that slip. Why? Because the American people have chosen presidents that have appointed, with the advice and consent of the Senate, justices that are less radical. Now, I'm sorry. I look at Chief Justice Roberts. Chief Justice Roberts doesn't give a whit about the Constitution unless it agrees with him. He's more interested about how the Supreme Court looks than the job it is created to do. I look at Gorsuch. I look at Kavanaugh. I look at Barrett. Barrett is still new, so I'm still looking for some more information out of her. But I see justices that are marginally better, marginally more basing their opinions on the Constitution and the law rather than previous judges' opinions or the whatever society deems to be true today. Now, if the Congress really thought that the Supreme Court should be simply larger, not biased, larger, they would say, fine, we want four more justices, but they're going to be chosen by the next four presidents. Seems to me to be fair, right? If they think the court just simply needs to be larger, but they don't want it controlled by their party, they would look around and say, nope, we want four more. We want them appointed by the next four presidents, or at least the next four administrations. See, that would be fair. That would be acting in the best interest of the country. But no, what do we see? We got to have four more, and we got to have them now. Why? Because we have control of the presidency. We have control of the Senate. Therefore, we get to put our people in office, in those judicial slots. We will take control of the courts. That is not ruling well. That is the domination of one faction over the other. That is the Democratic Party saying, listen, there have been three justices appointed by a Republican. We have to get four. We have to be in control. It is constitutional. It is also evil. It is disgusting. It should be grounds for disqualification from office. Anybody that supports adding a significant number of the justices to the court without allowing multiple administrations to appoint them is placing their party above their oath of office. They are enfeebling the public administration. They are attempting a coup, a bloodless coup, by trying to take over government. And it needs to be seen for exactly what it is. It is a political maneuver to take control of the government. The third area we see, well, that's DC statehood. I want one good reason why this federal city, Washington, D.C., should be a state. See, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, I believe, says that Congress has the power to exercise legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square, as may be cessation of the particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States. There's a reason why the seat of government of the United States does not exist within a state. And there's actually several reasons. Probably the first is we didn't want the seat of the United States under the sway of a state. See, right now, Washington, D.C. is governed by Congress. Now, Congress has said, D.C., you can have a city council, but Congress still has final say over any legislation in the city. They complain a lack of representation. They're represented by the entire Congress. If you live in D.C., you're represented by the entire Congress. Oh, but we don't have a voting member in the House. We don't have any senators. Yeah, because you're not a state. You don't have any senators because you're not a state, because you're not supposed to be a state. You're not supposed to have a state government add sway over the federal government. Not like that. For those of you who are pushing for D.C. statehood, let me ask you, what would happen if we were to move the seat of government from Washington, D.C. to, I don't know, Dallas, Texas? What if we were to move it to Omaha, Nebraska? What if we were to move it to Bismarck, North Dakota? How would you feel with a city that is 90%+ Democrat? I think they voted 94% for Joe Biden electors in the 2020 election, being stuck in the middle of a deep red state. A state that, let's say, had constitutional carry. A state that was pro-life. How would you feel? Yet you're more than willing to alienate a large percentage of the country in order to get 3 more votes in Congress, 1 in the House and 2 in the Senate. This has nothing to do with representation. They have representation in the vote for president. They have representation in the Congress. If you think that the people in Washington, D.C. really need to be represented by a state legislature, do what you would do if Washington, D.C. was a fort. Let the population be counted for the representation of Maryland. But do not put another entity in control of the federal city of Washington, D.C., the seat of the federal government. The only reason to do that is to take control of the federal government. Same with Puerto Rican statehood. The Puerto Rican people have voted multiple times not to become a state. Yet the Democrats want it. I try not to be partisan, but I'm sorry. I look at what people do and wonder, why do the Democrat, does the Democratic Party want to destroy the Republic? Why is it always the Democrats that appear to be, I should say not always, more often than not, why is it the Democrats that seem to be destroying the Republican model of government? Why is it the Democrats that seem to want to put out the sacred fire of liberty? And why do the American people let it happen? I read Washington's first inaugural address to give you a sense of the ideas of the men who founded this country and what it was created to be. That country is now in our hands. What are we going to do with it? Will we protect those sacred fires of liberty? And if so, how? Will we let the Republican model of government be dismantled by a political party that has for decades been ruled by animosity, by division, by racism, by classism, by sexism, and more recently, by Marxism. Now, I'm sure not all of those people who are members of that party are that way, but I look at the leadership, I look at the direction that this party is going and it is dragging this country, and what do I see? Is I see decisions based on race, I see divisions based on class, based on sex, based on Marxist ideals. And I wonder what the American people are going to do. Now, if you want to help, I can help you. All the information that you need actually is out there free, but sometimes you need a little help. So please head to constitutionstudy.com, absolutely free, find more information. You want to find others to discuss this stuff with, to learn, to study, to share, head to constitutionscholars.com. They're free. I've written books and classes and tools and videos to help you. Some of them, yes, I do charge them to help offset my costs, but they're there and we're there to help. So please take advantage. Make sure to check out America Out Loud. Use it for your daily news stop. Get news, get information, check the website, listen to the programs. Let's make sure that we know what's going on so that we can help secure America's future, the sacred fire of liberty, before it goes out. And I look forward to talking with you next time, right here in the Constitution Study.